allowing people to look at my story, which is, you know, that this horrific story that's what you think of when you think of stalking, the stranger who's lurking, it goes on forever, and pinpoint it back to how frequent stalking happens, and especially in a domestic and intimate partner setting, how frequent it happens and how it can escalate into assault, homicide, various different things.
They have the right to remain silent, not the ability.
So well stated. People started to ask me to talk and invite me to go talk in spaces and share my experience and share best practices. And as I like to say, I started talking and I never shut the fuck up. I just kept going. And so it was really...
Love it.
You and Michelle have something in common then.
If you're somebody who is single and you prefer dating women, you're probably dating somebody who has experienced some harm. Like, I don't really know any women that haven't. I think a lot of times we feel like, oh, we have to date if we're single. No, we don't. I'm fine on my own. I choose to. And so understanding that as well, but not jumping into a relationship just because it feels like I need somebody around to feel safe. As someone who's, as I said earlier, survived multiple crimes in my life starting at the age of 3, sometimes we're like more attracted to these people who are assholes because we're
Wait,
so used
what?
To being treated like
asshole
an asshole.
Factor?
No. Oh, what?
What? Never.
One of the things, can I make a psychoanalysis on Michelle? Is everybody comfortable with that?
So there was no
jury. So he's extra stupid.
You're my new best friend.
The information shared in this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only. It should not be construed as legal advice or a substitute for seeking professional legal advice. I'm Michelle Locke, and this is Love, Lust, Law. And today we are joined by someone fabulous. Although I have to say, like, in doing this podcasting, like, I'm meeting lots and lots of amazing people. But Anna in particular is amazing because of her story and her journey that brings her to where she is today. She's an international trainer, speaker, author, and subject matter expert, consultant, victim, and survivor. She focuses her work on stalking and victim-centered trauma-informed practices. That's a mouthful. But man, talk about smart, intelligent. She is a survivor of long-term stalking herself. And she brings rare lived experience alongside years of professional work with law enforcement, military, universities, and state and federal agencies through ANASIT Consulting and Training. She's the author of Now I Speak. She's also a recipient of the 2025 Peggy Klinke Award and serves in leadership and advisory roles with organizations including End Violence Against Women International, VINE, and CCVS. Let's dive in. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Tell the audience a little bit about your stalking story, because, I mean, that's really was the impetus for where you got to where you are today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started being stalked, to my knowledge, in about November 2011. In reality, he had probably been stalking me for several years prior. I think that we often think that, like, oh, this is the day this started, November 4th, 2011. You're like, no, it didn't. So I owned an art gallery out in Port Townsend, Washington, which is just this magical, weird, quirky community that's like known for wooden boat building and arts and food and all sorts of amazing things. So I had the absolute joy of owning an art gallery. Back at that time, I was in my early 30s. I, you know, did not have money to buy an art gallery, let me be very clear, but I had a passion to, so I wrote a damn good business plan and got a private investor and bought this gallery with, like, nothing in my bank account.
And good for you.
Thank you.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Exactly. And I'm still very proud of that. And at that point in my life, I'd just gone through a divorce. You know, things had not always, most of my life had, I come from, you know, kind of a middle-class, white, privileged background, but I'd also experienced multiple forms of gender violence throughout my entire life course, starting at the age of 3 years old. So at this point in my life, like, I've just gone through this divorce. I'm like, look out, world, let's go. Like, let's just watch me go. I'm going to shine. This is my time. No one can stop me. But as I said, unbeknownst to me, there was this man who had been watching me and stalking me. And he kind of, revealed himself one evening. I was working on a window at my gallery, so literally like on display in a window front. And he came and knocked on the door and gave me the gift of a painting and told me he wanted to show artwork at my gallery. And like,
Okay.
that wasn't that out of the ordinary that someone wants to show artwork. Like, you're an artist, you need to get it sold, right? But I got a weird feeling from him. I was just like, this is an odd interaction. So he left and I gave him my business card, no big deal. And that week I was super busy. I had a big gallery show, a big, party, all the things. And so Monday I saw that he had emailed me. He had left messages on the gallery phone. I was like, wow, this guy's real eager to show his artwork. And so I looked at it, was like, yeah, I have no interest in showing this, and sent him an email that said so. I mean, in a politer way, obviously.
Right.
And thought nothing of it. From there, he began to send me messages via Facebook. We were never friends on Facebook, but you can message anybody, especially back then, there was less security around that. And the messages just seemed really, they would bing bong back and forth between like expressing like affection, talking about my appearance, saying that I wasn't a good business owner. Saying things like, it was nice to see you today when I never saw him anywhere. And I was like, this is really weird. How is this guy that I saw on a Friday evening on a Tuesday saying it was nice to see me today?
Yeah, that's creepy.
Yeah, super creepy. So pretty quickly, I got the sense that something was wrong. And what I ended up doing was calling a friend of mine who kind of just knew anybody that caused problems in the community. This is a small town of about 9,000 people, so people know each other, right?
Yeah, everyone
And
knows everyone. It's 2 degrees of separation, not six.
exactly. And that really played to my advantage because my friend did know who this stalker was. At that point, I didn't even have language for the word stalking, but he knew who the individual was and said he had caused problems in the community in the past. I found that he'd been mandated to go to our local mental health center, and he had threatened violence against people there. So everything just kind of unveiled itself to me in really quick order. And I mean, I wrote a book about the whole thing. It's over 300 pages long, so I'm going to try and make it a real concise story here.
You're going to make a long story short.
Real short. I have a good friend that says, let me make a short story longer, but I'm going to make a long story short. So what would end up happening was that he continued his behavior and he actually was arrested in 2012. He ended up serving a 1 year sentence or 364 days in the county jail for misdemeanor harassment of me because, as you have to build all those charges up. And so he served a year. When he was released in 2013, he obeyed the protection order I have for the most part for quite a while. I have, at this point now, I have a lifelong protection order against him. It expires in 2099, which I think I will have expired before then.
You
But
never
he's,
know with modern science. You never
you
know.
never know.
You may just be a head in a fishbowl. We never know.
We don't know. So in 2013, one of the things he started to do and continues to this day is he likes to write a lot of letters and he sends them to law enforcement. He sends them to people he knows. He would send them to people I know. He would send them to elected officials, prosecutors, anybody. Loves to write a letter.
I
So
know a few of those. I have a few of those in my life.
right, you probably get some of those letters, and I
I
think that's
do.
something I think about a lot, like especially like my prosecutor who would end up taking our case all the way in 2019, of like he gets those letters that are threatening. And he has a wife and three children. And I often think about the incredible work that people like you do, Michelle, and how that puts you in harm's way as well. So thank you.
Well, you're welcome, but I don't bully real easily.
That's good. I love that. But what he started to do was send them to law enforcement initially, and they were really filled with a lot of threats and ways I should die, graphic things of that nature. He revealed that in his mind we were married. As far
Oh,
as like
Lord.
mental, yeah. So it established that in his mind he thought we were married, all these ways in which I should die. And that was really what we saw, was like this was not gonna let up. So
Yeah,
by the end of
he wasn't gonna
2000,
stop.
No. And so by the end of 2013, I closed my business because the day-to-day of being someplace where the stalker knows you are is debilitating. Just that like continuous place of fear of trying to like, sell things I couldn't even afford. And I, could barely sell anything at this point because I was just so on edge and anxiety ridden all the time. So that financial loss was massive, massive, massive. And by 2015, 2016, sorry, I relocated to where I live now in the state of Vermont.
Oh, how beautiful.
It is. It's real pretty. The little
Yeah.
green mountain state.
Oh.
Our slogan is the brave little state, which I really enjoy living in a brave little state because I'm a brave little thing.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So I moved here and I did take a quick visit back out to Washington end of 2016 to see friends because I was really missing my people. I never posted on social media I was going there, but he saw me, we're assuming he saw me at some point, and he started messaging me again, initially through a fake account and then through his own account on Facebook. And I didn't block him at this point because it's so easy for someone to just start another account.
Well, and you want to collect evidence. I mean, that's the other part, is collecting evidence.
Exactly. So, from that evidence standpoint, I just kind of kept it open, but would never respond to any of the messages. I think I only responded one time back in 2011 to tell him to, or maybe it was 2012, to say, please do not contact me via any
Right.
means. Don't come to my business. And I've never responded to anything else. And so, it took a long time for them to build up the case, and it actually moved over to the county next to where Port Townsend is. It's called Clallam County. And there was a prosecutor that saw the files and called me up and said, hey, I'm going to try and do the impossible. Stalking very, very rarely gets prosecuted, but I'm going to go for it. Do you want to go with me? And I said,
You're like, yes, please. Where can you sign me up?
yep, so big ups to James Kennedy, that prosecutor. He's now the prosecutor in Port Townsend. And took us 2 years to build that case. There's a lot of, legal reasons within that, as you
Yeah.
could imagine. And in 2019, we went to trial where he decided to defend himself because, of course, he did. It didn't go that well for him, by the way.
It usually doesn't.
Right?
They have the right to remain silent, not the ability.
So well stated. That is a great line. He did
Is.
not have the ability.
Nope.
So
And I am sure he got on that witness stand and told his story to the jury. And sometimes you don't need an expert to say someone's crazy. You just put an exhibit sticker on their forehead.
right. This was actually a bench trial, which was his own choosing. So there was no
So he's
jury.
extra stupid.
You're my new best friend.
I mean, defend, at least with a jury, like you may get a wonky juror that, like, because it has to be
Right?
unanimous. And so maybe you get like one crazy person on the panel, so you get like a hung jury or something. But you go to the bench, it's like, please, judge, convict me. And then you represent yourself. Lord have mercy. Captain Genius
Exactly.
there. Captain Genius.
Exactly. And he did not get on the witness stand. He chose not to.
Okay,
But I
that was
sat up.
smart.
That was his one smart one. I had the absolute horrible thing of sitting on the witness stand for a day and a half.
You were
And.
cross-examined by him. Oh, that was awful. I can only imagine.
I will say this, I had an incredible advocate here in Vermont who really coached me because all of our prep work is being done from thousands of miles away. And so I worked with an advocate here who really helped me so that I never looked at him. I found different places to focus. I just, and that I think was a huge piece of it because it really derailed him quickly. So the cross-examine did not go well for him. Pretty quickly, he just like fell apart into asking me about like my role in the Catholic Church's child sex scandals, things of that nature. And because he couldn't keep it together, the judge shut that down. But he was found guilty of aggravated felony stalking and felony cyber stalking. and ended up being sentenced to 10 years, maximum of 10 years, having to serve at least 6.25. And at the time, that was the longest sentence in our country's history that we know of, according to my friends at Spark and everywhere else. And so that really,
Wow.
to me, was like, wait, I don't want to be the exception where I got this lengthy sentence because I got sentenced too, right? When you're sentencing a stalker, you're also giving the sentence of freedom to the victims. And so I took my sentence of freedom and thought, let's get loud.
When you were going through this, what did you learn about the process when you went through it? And ultimately, what did you learn about yourself and what you were capable of?
I think one of the things that I really learned about going through this process is how mucky and miry and like just unknown the criminal justice system is for the regular person. And we get into this place of like, oh, if I go report to police, this is all going to wrap up like it does on TV in an hour, right? Like we're all going to be good. And so for me, it became this thing of really needing to understand the process. Because if this criminal justice process was going to decide things of my life that were outside of my control, I wanted to have knowledge around that. And so that was a big thing for me. And ultimately, like I ended up finding kind of my home within this work, which I was not anticipating at all to start to shift over to this field. And I think that, you know, as far as how it changes us and shows us strength, so often we just keep going. We're not even looking at it of going like, I'm strong, I've got this, like I can keep going. You just keep going. And that's a really big part that I think so many of us experience in life of we just keep going. And this happened to be the thing that I just kept going on. Even before the trial, I started to shift my career over into what I would say like the victim service world. I went to a course here in Vermont, the Vermont Victims Assistance Academy, that really helped kind of show me all the different pieces. And for me, it became important. I was like, well, I want to like give back because I lucked into the right law enforcement, the right prosecutors, the right advocates, the right judges. I lucked into best case response, and we can't luck into that. And so I started to go, how do I give back? How do I be in this space? And so through that academy, I initially started my business. I've changed its name now, but I started a business called Stand Up Resources to do graphic and web design for victim service agencies because my background is fine arts and I've done a lot of, you know, that type of work. And I do a little bit of that, but people started to ask me to talk and invite me to go talk in spaces and share my experience and share best practices. And as I like to say, I started talking and I never shut the fuck up. I just kept going. And so it was really
Love
You and Michelle have something in common then. Sorry.
yeah, I'm like, that sounds vaguely familiar.
I'm worse than both of you combined, actually.
I talked my way all the way to the White House under the former administration, but I mean, I just kept going. And I think through that, especially in the stalking field, there's very few of us who have lived experience that can talk openly. And so as we started to get connected with like Lenora Claire, when we connected, others that I've connected with over the years, and then starting to connect with Spark, our Stalking Awareness Resource Center, you started to just find a family. And a family of weirdos, because we all speak this really strange language, right? But a family where you don't have to explain anything. You can just talk about the things. And that's been so amazing, and especially to welcome new ones in, like becoming friends with Coles Whalen, who was the victim in the Counterman case versus the Supreme Court, like all of these different people. And when we get on a call, you know, we might not have ever met in person, but we are sisters and that's and brothers. And like it's just an incredible thing to have that and to also be allied and dear friends with people who might not have the lived experience but do the work, like our friends over at Spark, like a Pat Brady, different individuals like that, like Sherry Coronado, all these incredible people. I was just with a bunch of them in Dallas actually for a conference, and we went out for dinner, and it was, you know, 12 of us at this table, and we're just so excited to see each other. And we barely talked about the work. We're like talking about tattoos and dogs and plants and everything else, because it's like, yeah, we're just excited to connect. And so I think that's been a really special thing, is the connection point through this horrific experience of making these lifelong friends and collaborators.
Well, I want to jump in for a second, because you walk into these rooms where there's all of these, you know, campus officials, law enforcement, military personnel, like you walk into rooms of power. What's one of the first things that you've got to correct with regards to misconceptions about it?
Where do I start? I mean, the first thing is getting buy-in. I am not law enforcement. I am not military. I'm not, you know, a college leader. So the first thing is to find a connection point so that we can engage together. And I think that's so important, especially now, that we have to find connections with people. And then we can start having a conversation. So from there, I mean, depending upon my audience, it's asking how many people in the room think that stalking is against the law in all 50 states and all U.S. territories. And that first question, if it's a room of 100 people and only 10 hands go up, I know we got to start real low level and build from there. And I've had that happen many, many times. And so it's really engaging by sharing bits of my story, sharing information about stalking, and then allowing people to look at my story, which is, you know, that this horrific story, that's what you think of when you think of stalking, the stranger who's lurking, it goes on forever, and pinpoint it back to how frequent stalking happens, and especially in a domestic and intimate partner setting, how frequent it happens and how it can escalate into assault, homicide, various different things. So it's trying to crack people open and then educate them so that we can be aware that there are our friends, neighbors, our coworkers, maybe even us who are experiencing stalking, and start to give some tools to then be able to make reports, be able to document, be able to understand what your laws are. And then if I'm talking, like if I'm training law enforcement, usually I do like an 8-hour training for them. And it feels like I could probably do like a whole week long training at this point. But with law enforcement, of that 8 hours, they're maybe getting 10 minutes in which I share my story. And the rest is going to be all about their state-specific laws, about understanding and recognizing stalking, about looking at co-occurring crimes, about writing PC reports, about partnering with prosecutors, learning how to really build out the case. And that's, you know, a huge part as well, learning how to be trauma-informed, how to ask questions. You know, if a stalking victim walks in, most of the time we don't even have the language for the word stalking. It's usually cops or a friend. Yeah, it's someone who's going to identify for us and go, oh, that sounds like stalking. You're like, what? I'm experiencing what? So it's really helping these people who are those first responders have the language, have the questions, and have the practices to be victim-centered when they're interviewing, when they're investigating, when they're building out these cases.
Really, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for you to speak out when you were first going through this, right? There really wasn't many opportunities, if at all, for not only people to understand about stalking, but just find a place to speak openly and freely and kind of feel safe about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's really that, like, not wanting to be too public was, you know, a safety mechanism for me. And I think that's, you know, partially why I really rooted myself in the training of responders, right? But as I've had opportunities like being on Strictly Stalking, doing, you know, an article for Good Morning America, different things of that nature, it really kind of opened it up that I can train responders and I can create awareness for communities and awareness for the general public. So it was really a twofold approach. But I credit other survivors for really showing me that as well, of being out there. And it was something I really had to do a lot of thinking about as he was released the end of March. So most of my career in the stalking field, he's been incarcerated. And so when I had to look at, okay, end of March, 2026, he's getting out, what does my work look like? And there was a long time where I thought I would just close up shop and maybe go work at the general store in town. I don't know. But I decided not to. And And that's really been because I've been able to look at others who stayed loud even when that person was not in prison. And that was challenging to do. And I still have my hard days with that. And I think there's a lot of hard days to come, to be honest with you. He's back in jail right now, which is great. But he's going to bing bong in and out, and or we assume so. And so it's a lot to kind of look at. How do I create different security mechanisms, things of that nature? How do I speak on a show like this, knowing that he very well could listen to it? Like, it's a whole different chapter now, but one that I've realized I've made myself because of this work so incredibly safe. When I started looking at safety planning, looking at that pre-release stuff, I had some of the top people in the country who not only advise me, but I can call friends. And that's incredible. And so now I've been able to take some of those things that we did for my safety plan and share those with others, share that with law enforcement, share that with advocates across the country so that they can use those to help others. And I think I really look at it as being like I lucked into this best case outcome out of just a horrific situation. There's nothing lucky about it. But how do I continually take the things that were so well done for me in this case and replicate that for others who do not have that luck and do not have that advantage and don't look like me, don't speak like me, don't have the education, all of those different things. We have to look at like victims are all of us. And so how do we make sure that we're creating services and education and training for responders that can serve all victims?
And that's a really important thing because a lot of people don't understand what the resources are. And I think that a lot of people have turned to social media, have turned to podcasts and turned to other places to, number one, share their story. But you've kind of had to take on the mantle of not only being a protector for many of these people, but helping them understand what they've gone through as well. And even training a step further is how professionals need to deal with stalking survivors and how to take it seriously. And ultimately, for law enforcement to understand what resources they have to deal with this.
So, I mean, and I think that's something we have to think about. Like, if you're entering the law enforcement career and you're going to your academy for however long that might be, I think it's usually a couple months, I don't know, and you're going through that, one, you are being hammered with so much knowledge, so much information. You're also being physically very demanding practices as well. So you have to take into account how much are we actually retaining? Like when we're going to a course, if you're taking a course, a class, how much of an hour-long lecture are you actually retaining? And so if you're getting information, 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 and you're expected to be a jack of all trades in every single thing from high-speed driving to self-defense to being able to bring someone back to life if they're not breathing, to understanding all of these crimes, that's really hard, right? And so I think a lot of times these things like stalking, like that knowledge, it comes in and goes out. It comes in one ear and goes out the other. And so it's important then that we have these additional trainings that we're building out for law enforcement and for advocates and for prosecutors and for judges. And I think that's something I see so often is like, okay, the cop understands stalking and they're writing a great PC report and we're going for it. Advocates like full in, we've got a prosecutor, we've got all these things lined up, and then we have a judge that doesn't understand stalking and is like, yeah, no, not guilty. So it's really that full comprehensive spectrum that needs to be trained on this. And I think that if we look at it like this is how we save lives, it's pretty simple. If we take stalking seriously, we can save lives.
The toll that this has taken on your personal life. Dealing with a stalker is a career, not one that they could pay you enough to deal with. It's your lot in life, but you've been able to turn it around to basically become a warrior, become an advocate, and find strength where you didn't know you had it. But at the same point, it's not something you necessarily would have volunteered for. It's just presented to you, and you don't have an option. You don't have an option not to deal with this. So I want to know what toll this has taken on your personal life.
So a couple things I would say as far as like I think that being a victim of crime is a career, and it's one that it's a job that nobody applied for. we got no training on, and we're supposed to meet company standards on day one. It's next to impossible. And so that's a lot of like why I had to really educate myself to take on this job in life. And yeah, it takes a tremendous toll from, you know, losing my business, moving across the country, leaving the place I loved. The financial impact has been just absolutely gutting over the years. And then just that place of looking at housing, looking at jobs, if you're applying for one, things of that nature, very basic needs, I think become incredibly challenging for many victims, because who's going to rent to us? If I go to a landlord and I say, hi, I'd like to rent this place. FYI, I have a stalker that thinks we're married and wants to murder me. They're not going to rent to me. So I'm going to tell that after I sign the lease and say, if this person ever contacts you, please let me know. Same with jobs, you know, who's going to hire somebody like, oh, thank you so much for hiring me. FYI, I have a 150-mile protection order against this person because they think we're married and want to murder me and are stalking me. You don't want to hire that person. And I think what happens so often is victims were considered dangerous to be around. And so that can impact other things like dating, right? You know, if you're dating someone, they're like, yeah, I'm all set there. Especially back in the day when I was real quiet about this. I mean, now I can just literally hand them my book and be like, hey, read this book if you're interested. Let's see what we can do here. I mean, I think there's two things. Like, one, have I had men approach me who were voyeuristic and wanted to, like, were predatory? Absolutely, because of what I've experienced, things of that nature. And I could decipher that fairly quickly, thankfully. I do think the challenge with being a crime victim survivor and also a multi-crime victim survivor is that you sometimes end up being attracted to people who will replicate those patterns because you're so used to that. And so for me, I've had to do a lot of work. I have a great therapist. All about therapists, let's go. And do a lot of work around that and a lot of understanding around that. But I think, you know, if you're somebody who is single and you prefer dating women, you're probably dating somebody who has experienced some harm. Like, I don't really know any women that haven't. And I know that's a blanket statement, but I think that whether we're outward facing or we never tell you, and I mean, that's something that I've had happen of, like, especially after writing my book, having male and female victims come to me and say, I've never told anybody this, but this happened when I was a child, or this happened in college. And so it doesn't matter if we disclose or not. You just need to be kind and be gentle and understand that we're all just trying to walk through this world. And if you're lucky enough to find somebody that can understand your tics and all those things, that's really important. And I know that's been really important for me in my journey of just like, yeah, I'm a weirdo. You need to understand that I need to pick my seat before you do when we go out to dinner, because I want to sit so I can see all points of entry and exit. That's really important to me. Those little things of understanding that behavior make such a huge difference. And that at the end of the day, like, you can also be a really big support to somebody. Like, I'm not somebody who's going to go walk alone in the woods by myself and go hiking by myself. That is terrifying to me. But I'd like to go. So if I'm dating somebody who wants to go take me, that's an awesome thing. And I feel lucky that I have that right now. So that's been really nice.
A lot of times when you're dating somebody, and I have dated women who have gone, as you said before, the odds are you're going to meet somebody or date somebody or be with somebody who has gone through some sort of horrific pattern of, at the very least, harassment, at the very most, abuse. So when you walk through these sort of paths, like, you have to sort of identify between what is personalized to you and what you represent and the separation there, okay, in terms of safety, in terms of male, in terms of being able to trust. And I think that's one of the things, is that a lot of times people personalize it because the survivor you're with may not even at that point have the language to communicate exactly what they're feeling, what they're going through, and basically what their needs are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's really important that we listen to people, that we start by believing. As you know, I'm a board member for End Violence Against Women International, and we have the Start By Believing campaign. Pretty simple thing that anybody can do if somebody discloses to you. We start by believing, and we don't get into the voyeuristic dirty details. Let that individual share what they want to share, if they want to share it, and don't blame them. Don't question why you did this versus that. Be a supportive individual who can allow that person to open up to them when and if they feel that they want to. And I think also a big thing for me, whether it's somebody you're dating or just a friend in your life or community member, I've had so many people say to me over the years, oh, if he tries to attack you, just call me, I'll be there. That is one of the most unrealistic statements, and I understand it comes from a place of love and care, but I think we have to be very aware when we are offering support that we have to offer support that we can actually follow through with. Because the last thing a victim needs is if you're like, I can be there to walk you to your car every day, and you can't, it's another thing that's been let down by them. It's another piece of the system, their personal safety system, that's been let down. And so I think it's important that we offer realistic things.
When you look at survivors that you've coached, met, advocated for, are there steps that they need to take? And I know this is kind of a blanket statement because everybody, there's different crimes here we're talking about. You know what I'm saying? You're talking about DV, you're talking about SA, you're talking about stalking, you're talking about all these things that pull somebody out of a system of what the boundaries of safety are, right? It really pushes the boundaries of challenging that and who is safe in their lives. So that being said, is that are there steps or are there things that you tell them in order of how to sort of protect yourself out there? Like, what kind of things should you do or not do in order to start even going on one date again?
I think that it really depends upon the individual and what they can access. So like I said, like, I have a really good therapist, but not everybody can access that or afford that. So, I mean, I think that's a great step. But I think it's just really thinking about, you know, what are the things that you can do to really center into yourself? Some people, that's just being able to sit and breathe, meditate a little bit, things of that nature. So making sure that you're focusing on yourself in that process. And then, I mean, I think in this world, like, most people are meeting people online, which, you know, is its own complexity and fears as well. So it's simple things like making sure one of your friends knows where you are, you know, things of that nature. But I think it's really complex, and it's really up to the individual how they want to proceed with that. And what they want in their life is a big piece too. Like, some people, I think a lot of times we feel like, oh, we have to date if we're single. No, we don't. I'm fine on my own. As someone who's, as I said earlier, survived multiple crimes in my life starting at the age of 3, sometimes we're like, more attracted to these people who are assholes because we're
Wait,
so used to
what?
Being treated like
asshole
an asshole.
Factor? No.
Oh, what?
What? Never.
And I mean, truly, like, for me, like, it was a couple years ago. I was like, I'm good. I'm all set. Like, I got done dirty by this guy. I was like, I'm done. I'm done. I can't trust myself. I have the worst picker. All of these things.
Sister, I am right there with you. And I'm like,
I moved into this place I live now, and I called it the Spinster's Paradise. And I literally, Michelle, you're going to love this. I made myself a registry and sent it to my friends. It was like, I'm never getting married. I bought you all wedding gifts. Here's my registry.
That's awesome for so many reasons.
And then I ended up meeting somebody at my local little dirtbag bar. Like, it's just, you know, like a little hole in the wall. I love it so much. And I met somebody when I was on an absolute feminist tirade. And I was really upset because it was the Super Bowl, and my friend has a snack theme for his Super Bowl party, and it was the year that they renamed the Gulf of Mexico, so he had to be the Gulf of Snacks. So I had tried to make little brioche vaginas with coat hangers in them to make the Gulf of Reproductive Rights. And my bakes had failed, and I was so pissed off when I was on this tirade, and that's how I met the guy I'm dating.
Well, if he, I guess, can put up with you in that tirade, he must be a keeper.
He's something.
You know, I think it's interesting, and Michelle, you've dealt with this in both divorces and many of the cases that you've covered in family law, And how often stalking does take a predominant role in these cases?
Oh, it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Well, I mean, I think that there's always a level of stalking in about every relationship that ends.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that's the reality of it.
I think that I'm working on a project right now for New York State for their law enforcement on stalking and domestic violence. And it's everywhere in there. And if we take that seriously, we don't have to maybe get to some of these horrific results. And that's the hard thing, is getting everyone to understand how serious of a threat it is, that it's not a low level crime, but we treat it low level. We treat it as come back when something worse happens. Well, what's worse that happens? I'm dead.
Right.
Can't really come back at that point. So it's really understanding those pieces of it within, especially that the intimate partner, domestic violence world, the divorce world, all of that, where it's everywhere.
All the time. And I mean, I was talking to a friend just this morning, and it was about Life 360 and her husband tracking her. And her husband's like, no, you're not there. Life 360 says you're here. And I mean, that happens all the time. And it's a form of stalking. Now, what everyone will say is, oh, no, it's just so we can keep tabs on the family. I think in some regards, if you've got kids, appropriate, because you know where they are. I understand that. But when it comes to spouses, and if there's trouble in the relationship, and then you think about their cars, I was like, girl, make sure you call your car company and make sure he's not tracking you through the car, because if y'all are both on it, he can. So I'm like, and so it's things that people don't even think about.
Through smart appliances, through cars, through, I mean, and it's so infuriating. I heard this on your last podcast of looking at, like, what's the spyware that could be put on your phone, and your guest was saying, I can't even start to name it because there's always new things popping up. Like, it's, and I think this is a really hard thing from a response place, is people are like, I'm being cyber stalked. I'm like, where do we even start when we're untangling this?
Well, and that's me. And how do you stop it? Because as soon as you figure out, okay, this is the method they're doing it this time, the method completely changes for the next time. And I think Alan was telling us that it's as simple as someone can send you a text. And if you open that text, it will install stuff on your phone that they could basically mirror your phone. I'm like, well, shit.
Yeah.
Like, how do you stay safe? Like, what do you do?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, like, I didn't think of, I was saying to Jake that the stalker in my case was released 2 months ago. And so we did a massive amount of safety planning around that. But one of the things I didn't think about was when I moved, I entered Safe at Home program here in Vermont. So I have my address is not known. Love that for me. But I didn't think about my old address and that a family bought that house. And yes, I'm thousands of miles away, but I don't want them to ever receive anything. So I was like, okay, how do I get all my addresses swiped? So I went to Delete Me, which is, great tool. But I did it, like, it takes a couple months for them to catch it all and to get all of that off there. And I did it like 2 weeks before he was released. I was like, crap. All of these little things that really fall. I mean, as we talk about the job responsibility of being a victim of crime, especially a crime like stalking, where it can follow you until either his life is over or mine is really daunting.
No, it's a full-time job.
I estimate that I spent at least 300 hours safety planning in the year and a half leading up to his arrest. At least. And, what I also was able to do with that was to really create detailed recommendations for others, which is really important to me. And I also was lucky that I had the time to do it.
Well, yeah, because if you're a working person with kids, single, whatever else, like, where do you find the time? Because you've got everything else to manage.
I mean, I work all the time, so I can also do those things. Like, I mean, my advocacy center is 45 minutes from my house. So to go meet with my advocate, I have to drive 45 minutes. Luckily, I have a car and I don't have kids to worry about, and I work for myself. But if I didn't have those things, that's really challenging if I was Mary who works at McDonald's, right?
Right. Or Mary who works for a state agency that's got 8 to 5, 9 to 5 hours, like, where you've got to be tethered to your desk the entirety of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what do you do?
Yeah.
you really have to earn your safe spaces. And it's unfortunate that it has to be that way, but you have to really not only seek them out and be trusted in those spaces, but get yourself to a place where you're comfortable enough to share and comfortable enough to invite people. And both of you have done this. And I do want to mention, Michelle is going to write a book. Michelle is going to journal many of the things she's experienced, some of the things that have come to light, other things that have yet to come to light. But we've decided to take all the transcripts from this podcast as her starter pack to be able to do this, because this is like a confessional in a way. And she's very raw. And thank you so much. And so I want to know, from your standpoint, you've written a book. What tips would you give Michelle for being somebody who is a survivor, but also being vulnerable enough to connect with people through your words?
The publishing world is really gross. I'm just going to warn you with that.
Yeah, I figured.
I mean, I could go on like an hour-long tangent about that, of my journey within that, because I didn't have enough social media followers, or because my story was primarily about stalking and he didn't assault me, so it wasn't that bad.
I didn't die, so we're not going to talk about it.
Yeah.
We know someone that's what happened with.
So that's really challenging. But I would say the writing part of it, I really loved. I love to write. I mean, it really pulled back onto my creative side. It was really hard, too. I had to go back through all of this evidence and all of these different pieces. And it was wild to just kind of look back over this piece of my life. And that process of just kind of going chapter to chapter of, like, I had outlined everything. I mean, I'd done my whole book proposal. I did post-it notes of chronology for each chapter. And it was like my whole table was filled with them. And it's really weird to look at that. I remember going outside one day and my upstairs neighbors were outside doing something in their garden. And they're like, how you doing? I was like, well, I just talked about when I was sexually assaulted. Now I'm getting back to the part where, you know, he starts writing letters about how I should be murdered. So I'm doing great right now. Really good.
Fabulous. How are you?
They're very good friends of mine, so I could say stuff like that. But, and I think that's the important part, is like creating this time and the space for it as well. Like, it really, I wrote part of it when I was house sitting at this beautiful place in Maine. And then I wrote another part of it. I kind of wrote it three different pieces of time, but I really set aside the time. It was like, this is your job for the next 2 weeks, is to write this. And like, it had to be, I was able to go from being crime victim as a job to writer as a job. And I really relished those moments and that space. And yeah, sat there in my late father's sweater and just curled up with him. And like, those pieces, it was a really special, very solitude times. It was interesting to me, the things I thought were going to be the hardest to write were not. There were surprise ones, especially writing about my late father passing, because that was a really pivotal moment in my life. And writing about that, and I had a really good dad. I'm very lucky in that way. So I remember like that piece, like that chapter, I sat there sobbing as I wrote. And then I could write something else that was like absolutely horrific, just typing away. So it's
you compartmentalize that part so well.
Yeah, it's a really surprising journey what comes up. I don't find like going out and speaking to be healing. People are like, it must be so healing. I'm like, yeah, standing on a stage and bearing like horrific things about my life is not exactly healing. It's educational. It serves a point. Writing for me, I found very healing. It's always, you know, the people who come up to you and find themselves in that. And I think, yeah, I wrote this in like my prelude, maybe. It's just, I say something, it's like, you know, my story isn't that unique. This is a story that so many people could identify with and find themselves in. What's unique is I have the ability to share it. Yeah. And
it takes some gumption to share the story.
And I had the safety to share it. So
yeah.
That's really brilliant advice, actually. One of the things, can I make a psychoanalysis on Michelle? Is everybody comfortable with that? I vote yes. So, and I'm the one who's, I control this session technically, not spiritually, okay. But technically I control. I can always add it to, don't make it, Michelle. But the reason I want to say this is that, and I'm not trying to float your boat, Michelle, but I'm telling you, Michelle is a very compelling writer, and she doesn't get very many moments to herself. She doesn't get very many moments because she's always in demand by other people, situations, dealing with personal things in her life, professional things. But one of the things that we've been able to do with the podcast is sort of trigger her memories again. Like, we'll go down memory lane and it just kind of opens up this sort of cornucopia of nostalgia.
This one time at band camp? Oh my God.
I forgot about that one.
Like, that's it.
The dog with the tracheotomy at Thanksgiving. Like, oh. I'd forgotten about that one.
But that's kind of how life works. Michelle doesn't really get those. And I, you know, every time I think of Ramon, I think of Tiger Lady from Baby Boom. Did anybody ever see that movie?
I love Baby Boom with Diane Keaton.
Exactly.
One of my favorite movies.
Exactly. So I can imagine Michelle in a cabin with the little smokestack going up like that. Yes. And I know that'll never happen. She'll never have time for that.
You know, ironically enough, I was talking about like dream homes last night, like what would be involved in it. I'm like, mountains, the crisp, cool air in the morning blowing through the trees, an old school like rock fireplace, and like a log like type cabin. Oh no, Jake, I could totally do it. So long as I have Wi-Fi, we're good.
We're good.
And DoorDash.
You can go anywhere.
And DoorDash. No, I love cook. I can cook. I love
and
that.
A satellite for all your sports games. But other than that, we're all good.
I mean, I don't have DoorDash where I live, so that's always an unfortunate thing. I like a weirdo when I, because I travel so much, I'm like, ooh, DoorDash at the hotel. I get so excited. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. One thing I found is a lot of people are like, well, what's the next book you're going to write? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm trying to kind of figure that out a bit for myself, but you know, this book was not easy, but it's like, I knew the story, right? It starts November 4th, 2011, and it ends September 2019. Now, within it, I allowed my book to trigger a lot of memories, so there's other pieces of my life that filter through it. But it's interesting now to go like, okay, what would I write about next if I was writing like about a theory or about best practices, things of that nature, but I'm getting excited to think about that.
Your story is one that I think inspires others because like we're just regular everyday people. You're and what you said in your prelude is really kind of true, which is this is not a unique story.
Nope.
But I'm here to share it and hopefully someone can learn from what you've been through, what I've been through, and Jake's been through some stuff too. But I mean, the whole purpose is, from my perspective, is to educate and then make the next generation coming up smarter and better than we were.
Yep. I think of it this way, like, I don't do this work because I'm going to see results in my lifetime. And I have gotten to see some results, and that's been amazing. But we're doing this work that those before us did, that those after us will do, to keep trying to make it better. And I do know when we went to the White House under the Biden administration for the VAWA 30th anniversary, several hundred people there. And I just remember looking around at these like, elderly people, mostly women, elderly women of color who have done incredible work with so little. And sorry, I'm getting choked up. I don't get choked up very often, but I just looked at that and thought, like, we're here to keep passing that on, to do that for the next and the next and the next. And it's just so incredibly important that we keep pushing so that we can have a little fairness. We can have a little peace. We can seek those things out in a really, really dark world, because it is a very dark world. And
there's evil. There's absolutely evil. And I think it's a mistake for people to think that there's not.
Yep.
I think it's a disservice for the message out there that says, oh no, everyone can get the help they need and everyone can get better. No, there are some people that cannot, y'all. Some people that cannot. There is evil. And sometimes you can see evil really early.
Yep. You really can.
And until you see it, you don't believe it. But the minute you see it, you're like, holy cow.
Yep.
Michelle, why did you look at me when you said that? I'm a little concerned. Tell me, how did she look right at me? She's like,
right at you, right into your soul. Yeah, I mean, when you look at like behavioral assessments and like looking at like, you know, there's what happened to that child to possibly make them that way, and or are they just born that way?
Right.
And that's, I mean, there's the twofold of it, but I, you know, have seen evil several times in my life. And for me, the man who stalks me embodies it. Like, he is an evil monster, and I'm really glad I'm alive to get to hang out with you today.
I'm glad you're alive.
Both of you bring this sort of badass powerhouse that you're like, you understand how to deal with men. You really both do in that capacity. And that's not an easy thing.
Okay, maybe professionally, not always personally.
Not personally.
Well, I didn't say that. I didn't cross that line. We all know that's an issue. But let's not, ladies, we don't have time for that. That's a dating show. We don't have time for that.
Here's what I'm going to add. Men aren't really that hard to, like, work. Y'all are not. It's not hard.
Mm-mm. Sort of like we're basic bitches is what you're telling me.
No, it's just... Once a woman knows how to do it, then we just perfect it.
Yeah. This is really interesting. When my book came out, and still to this day, I'm surprised by how many males have read it and how many males identified in it. That was really an amazing thing to me. Because I've had people say to me, they're like, oh, you've had all these things happen to you at the hands of men, blah, blah, blah. Like, don't you hate men? How could you? Like, I'm like, no.
I don't hate men.
I don't hate men.
I hate some men. Like, yeah, sure. Hate them with a passion.
Absolutely. But that resonates with me of, like, the writing piece for me of being able to have a lot of male readers who really identified within it. It's a good thing.
Both of what you bring to the table is the ability to connect with males and make males understand to help educate other males. Because I think that's the thing. I do not need to be telling women what to do or women how to behave or women how to navigate themselves through life. I need to be telling other males. I need to be holding other males like myself accountable for some of the behavior and really educate them on how to conduct themselves, especially with women.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a very important thing. Is that we need men to talk about this stuff. We need y'all. Like, we absolutely need men to be out there speaking about gender-based violence, speaking about domestic violence, speaking about all of this, speaking about stalking, understanding how to hold one another accountable. It's so incredibly important because, you know, these movements have been built primarily on the backs of women. And we have to have others join us. It's so incredibly important. What I think really made a difference and allowed me to go the distance from 2017 to 2019 was that my prosecutor brought me to the table. And it was the first time I didn't feel like I was a victim in another room or another house. I felt like I was at the table with everybody. And what a difference it makes when we all sit at a table together, whether it be in a case like this or just in life. It's so incredibly important.
I've raised three boys, soul raising, you know, they're never quite done. But like, the one thing that I always wanted to ensure they knew is that none of us are better than the others, right? We all have different roles to play. We all bleed red. And each gender, each person all has their good sides, their bad sides, and we're all at the end of the day human.
Yeah.
Right? But if we can't figure out, and you know, Jake knows my belief. Like, I'm so not a man hater. I'm very much think men can be fabulous, just like women are fabulous. But let's be honest, there can be some women that are terrible. There can be some men that are terrible. That's just the reality of it.
Because there's evil people everywhere.
It doesn't matter
your
gender.
Bad people everywhere.
Doesn't matter your gender. And so, but at the end of the day, we're all part of the human race. And that sounds like very like kumbaya, which I'm not, like everyone hold hands and sing. That's just not me.
No,
but,
me neither.
But we should be. I mean, that should be the goal is, guys, if we all just gave, and Jake and I talk about this all the time, it's just some kindness. Like, if you were just kind to one person today, and that person was kind to one other person today, do you know, like, the difference that can make and just, like, the ripple effect?
Like, it's massive.
It costs us nothing to do it. It costs us nothing to help out someone else that may be in need for some particular reason. And you always help in the way that you can. Doesn't always have to be financial. Sometimes it's there, there'll be a shoulder for them to cry on because they've had just a shit week. And yep. Sometimes it's the, that's right, girl, he's an SOB, or that's right, dude, she's a you know what. Like, it's sometimes it's the simplest things make all the difference. And sometimes sharing, when it comes to stalking, just a simple trick. Hey, you may want to try this to help you keep you safe. Something like simple like that, like going to delete me, like doing it, like one small step can change an entire person's life. So why aren't we, like, as a collective unit, doing more to help each other out?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we can't be guarding these tips, these tricks, things like that. And it's also just, yeah, the piece of just giving to people. Like, I love to cook. So I have a freezer full of soup. And when a friend of mine is having, you know, she's, you know, exhausted, her and her husband and her kid and everything else, it's like, here's some freezer meals. Or my
will you come bring them to Texas, please?
Of course I will.
You just should hang out. You'd have fun, actually.
I bake a lot. And, like, one of the things for me is, I mean, I spend a lot of time alone, right? Unless if I'm, like, traveling for work. I work from home. I work alone. A lot of my work needs to be very private. So it's not like I can go sit at a coffee shop, as you understand, Michelle.
I do.
And so I do a lot of baking. And one of the things I like to do is I bake and then I give it away. But when I do that, what's awesome is then I get to connect with people.
Yeah.
So it's partially selfish that it's like, ooh, I made this thing. Here you go. You're going to smile. It's a kindness. But that comes back to me as well. And I think that when we're kind to others, it gives back to ourselves too.
You know, I was thinking, like, the fact that you can bake, I have so much admiration and respect for. Like, I can cook. I cannot bake. Because baking takes precision and patience, and I don't have either.
I love a good 18-hour bake. I love something that's going to take 18 hours to rise off and on, things of that nature. Like, let's go.
Oh, no.
Because it's not active time, and, like, you really, like, it is precise, but it's like I could start a loaf of bread last night, and I could be working today, and then I go do the thing. I come back and do my work, and I don't know. And it's challenging. I think it's... The precision of it is good for me because I tend to be very creative and a little ethereal sometimes. And so I like the preciseness of it. And if I fuck it up, I just throw it out. It's a couple sets of ingredients.
I don't like failing.
And yeah, so, I like this about it.
No.
I like the failure aspect of, like, okay, what did we learn here? How do we move forward? It's an egg and some flour and some water, which, you know, I don't like throwing away food, but it is that piece of, like, okay, what did I do wrong? So, yeah.
Do you want to tell our audience where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me on the Instagrams at ANNA.NASSET. My website is on anasset.com or anassetconsulting.com. And those are the best two ways to find me at this point.
Where can we find your book?
My book is available through your local bookstore. You can order it. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the different places. It's called Now I Speak. So there's that as well.
We'll make sure we put a link in the show notes for it. And I think, Cosmo, maybe that'll be our bedtime story tonight. What do you think?
It's a real dark bedtime story.
Well, you know, whatever helps you sleep, right?
Right, exactly.
You do you, boo. Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Love, Lust, Law. If you want to find me and Cosmo as he pushes me out of the way, you can find me on all socials at Attorney Michelle Locke. Just remember, Michelle is with one L, and you can thank my mother, Margot, with no T for that. Have a great one.